Check. 1, 2, 3. This is our third part, probably the final part, in a series about vegetarianism. We're, as Christian devotees, we're more than just vegetarians. We're Christianarians. To be a vegetarian means to reduce your karma by a factor of maybe hundreds and hundreds of times. To go from taking as your sustenance highly evolved living beings with blood flowing through their veins, with highly evolved nervous systems who scream in pain and agony and try and protect their and preserve their lives in the same way we would, to go from that level of bloodletting and pain and violence to go to the level of eating cauliflowers and apples and oranges and harvesting grains is a huge drop in your karmic liability. But it doesn't eliminate karma altogether, after all. Some vegetables that we eat, they're living beings. Most aren't, to be honest with you. Grain is brown when you harvest it. It means the life force has left it. Most mature vegetables, the life force has already left them, and they're still full of nutrition. And that's the harvest period. There's a window of opportunity between when the life force is left and when it begins to rot. That's called the harvest period. If we take it and if we put it in a cold environment, we can preserve the nutritional value and we can eat it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're killing to sustain our lives. But that's not true in every case. You know, maybe a baby carrot. Nika has, they do the baby carrots for the carrot juice in the Jamba Juice. Maybe a sprout, a bean sprout, an alfalfa sprout. You cut it down in its youth, not giving it a chance to reach its full maturity. For most part, to be a vegetarian is to be nonviolent. You take an apple from the tree doesn't die. You milk a cow, the cow doesn't die. So for the most part, you're not committing any violence. But it's not totally violence-free. And so therefore, Krishna makes a covenant in the 9th chapter, 27th verse of the Bhagavad Gita. If you offer me in love and devotion flower, fruit, leaf, or water, I will accept it. Flower, fruit, leaf, water, or milk products. This means that Krishna's the one taking the responsibility. He's not coming down and chewing the food because he's God, he's spiritual, he doesn't need food in the same way that our material bodies do. But if we offer to him in love and devotion, he agrees to play the role of the consumer. And he agrees to take the responsibility. He's God. I mean, he kills everyone anyway. By God's arrangement, we come to the end of our lives according to the actions and reactions of our own karma. But we live according to the pre-arrangements of God. If we violate those arrangements, we die ignorant and unhappy and unfulfilled. If we follow those arrangements, we just get the opposite result. So Krishna, actually, God kills everyone anyway, or he makes that world which brings everyone to the day of their own demise. So there's no question of Krishna getting karma. He absorbs all that and he's not liable in the same way that we are. So he says, I accept the offering, and that means that he accepts whatever karma there might have been in the offering. And so going from vegetarianism to prasadam is a step from some measure of liability, accountability, to a totally guilt-free, karma-free diet. But of course, one must offer Krishna the things that Krishna asks for, and not meat, fish, or poultry, or any of those things. So getting into today's topic, George Bernard Shaw says, while our bodies are the living graves of murdered animals, how can we expect any ideal conditions on earth? This is part of a longer poem where he says, we go on Sundays to pray for peace, and yet our bodies are the graves of murdered beasts, you see. Cruelty begets its offspring, war. There's a karmic connection between ingesting the flesh of animals, which they do not willingly give up so that we can enjoy the luxury of eating them. There's a connection between that and the violence that we see in war. We had World War I, we had World War II, we had the Vietnam War. Now we've got two major wars that America's fighting. It's said that at any given time on the face of the earth, there are at least 50 different wars being fought. You know, I go down to the field house 3 days a week for running, and the ROTC are always there. They're always training. And they're nice kids, they're clean-cut kids, and they're sacrificing themselves for protecting the country. But war isn't like what it used to be. war isn't where a soldier stands up against a soldier and they bash each other until one of them falls down. I mean, you get hit by a rocket or a missile thousands of miles away. You know, there's weapons that are just unimaginably destructive and diabolical. So I don't even know what, I mean, I don't even know if you can call it war in any kind of traditional sense at all. It's just technology and pushing buttons and killing people, and not only soldiers, but innocent people, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away. And of course, America can't claim innocence. We were the first ones to drop the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We had reasons for doing it, but then again, it says that in every victory are the seeds of a future defeat. In every victory are the seeds of a future defeat. What comes around goes around. These guys, they feel they have just as legitimate an excuse to explode an atomic bomb in New York as we did in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I mean, I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying we were right. But in their minds, they feel that whatever violence they perpetrate by whatever means on the American people, that we're all complicit in whatever it is that they consider that we're doing wrong. And so they would consider it a highly moral act, just as we considered it, and this is all subjective, just as we considered a moral act, or at least the lesser of two evils, to drop bomb in Japan, they would also consider it a moral act, or the lesser of two evils, to disable or cripple America. And the violence in the Bhagavad Gita, it explains that the more that you distance yourself from God, the more that you put God on the edge of your life and try and figure out things yourself, the more that you see yourself as the controller, the more that you see yourself as, it falls upon me to get revenge. You see, my people were kicked out of Palestine in 1948, and so now I've got to make things right. Actually, only one person makes things right, and that's God. But when you try to become God, then the syndrome is described in the Bhagavad Gita, Ishwaraham Aham Bhogi. We start to see ourselves as the controller. We start to assume the role of God. Ishwaraham means I see myself as the Lord, the enjoyer, Aham Bhogi, and everything is mine. And so this mentality results, as it explains in the Bhagavad Gita, in horrible, horrible, unbeneficial works, ugra karmana, meant to destroy the world. And it's interesting also that when the first atomic bomb went up in Alamogordo, New Mexico, the team of scientists who created the bomb, the head of the team of scientists, his name was Joel Oppenheimer. And when he saw from his bunker, and obviously with dark glasses on, when he saw that first mushroom cloud go up, he quoted Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. He quoted Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. He didn't quote the Sanskrit, but the Sanskrit is Kaloshmin Loka Seakrit Pravrito. Kaloshmin. Kalo means time. Time I am, and I have come to destroy all the worlds. He said it in English, but that was the translation. The more that we see ourselves as controllers or enjoyers, the more that we can justify these kinds of unbeneficial, horrible works. Leo Tolstoy, man suppresses in himself unnecessarily the highest spiritual capacity, that of sympathy and pity toward living creatures like himself, and by violating his own feelings becomes cruel. I always explain it this way. I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to suffer. Does anyone want to suffer? Does anyone want to suffer? Does anyone get out of bed in the morning and pray, you know, let me break my leg at soccer practice today, or fall off the veranda? Nobody prays like that. And when you think about it, you know, everything in Western advancement or achievement is, if there's a misery, Western science acknowledges that there's a chain of cause and effect. And so if there's a misery, if there's something that's unwanted, Western science will go and determine the cause and then remove the cause and thus remove the effect. That's the whole premise of Western science and advancement in technology, in medicine and all kinds of things like that. So if we think about it, if we ask ourselves, what is the ultimate cause of suffering? Why am I suffering? Why am I suffering? Every day there's some enjoyments and there's some suffering. What is the cause of the enjoyments in my life? What is the cause of the suffering? Now, if we bring into play, into the equation, the principle of karma, we conclude, it's not rocket science, that the cause of my suffering is a suffering that I have caused to other living beings. And even human beings have a sense of this. Most people have a sense of this, but they only limit it to other human beings. They only can see a reaction to how they treated other human beings. They had that television show about Earl. Remember Earl? What was it called?
My name is Earl.
Huh? My name is Earl. So he had a list of 237 human beings that he'd played tricks on, that he'd cheated, that he'd offended. And in his life, when the series starts, he was in the hospital with a cast and has lost his money, had lost his girl. Everything was going wrong, and he came to the same conclusion that all the things that are going wrong in my life are due to things that I caused, that I did to other people. Now I'm getting it back. See? So then he made a list of 237 people. And so the whole thing, I don't know if they ever got to the 237th episode, but every episode he would pick one person and try to search them out and try to make it right, you see? And at the end, there was always like a little, I didn't even watch it, but I heard about it. There was always like some little feel-good thing, you know, that he felt like he was on the right path, and there was some little encouragement or sign that he was in fact whittling down his karma. And I'm sure that as far as it went, there's some validity there, but the point is that it's not just the human beings that we incur liability. If Earl hurt, even while he's addressing the wrongs that he did to human beings, every day he's eating hamburgers and steaks and ham and turkey. So there's no way that he's going to get rid of his karma unless he realizes that pain is pain, and it crosses the lines of species. We're not the only ones that feel pain. And it's not only by hurting human beings that you get a reaction. You get reactions also from hurting animals. It's not necessary. In the Bible it says, he who killeth an ox, it is as if they killed a man. It is as if he killed a man. You live here on this farm with all the llamas and the cows and the parrots and all like that. They're so individual, aren't they? I mean, every one of them is a distinct, interesting, intelligent, unique individual. And you can't just push that under the table. You can't just discount that. They are as individual and as sentient as we are, and they're as deserving of life. If we had to kill them, that would be another thing. But we don't. Not only do we not have to kill them, but it's healthier. American Cancer Society, Medical Association, they all verify that it's healthier to eat a plant-based diet. When I grew up, they had the food chart. They had the food chart, and I think the most consumed foods at the base of the chart had to be eggs and meat and pork and poultry. And then the next least consumed is vegetables and then fruit, and then fruits, you know. Now it's completely different. Now the most consumed fruits are vegetables and grains, and then fruit. And the meat is just a little thing at the top of the pyramid. And it even says, it's okay if you don't even eat meat as long as you eat, breads and whole milk and things like that. So it's completely changed in my generation. So when you don't have to eat meat, and not only do you not have to eat meat, but it's healthier for you, and of course it's healthier for the animal, then certainly one incurs great liability doing otherwise. Again, some pictures of the strife between human beings and the horrible weapons that they use to inflict pain and suffering on each other. It's a fact that meat eating reduces respect for all kinds of life, including that of humans. One argument often used is, why are you bleeding hearts wasting so much compassion on the animals? Don't we have enough violence in human society to worry about before we worry about the animals? But it starts with how we treat the animals. Jesus Christ said, whatever you do to the least of them, you do to me. Even whatever you do to the ant or the sparrow, you do to me, because they're all sons and daughters of God. They're all creatures of God. If a father has 10 sons and one has Down syndrome and the other 9 are doctors or lawyers, he loves the Down syndrome child as much as the doctors and lawyers. It's not that the doctors and lawyers have a greater right to live than the Down syndrome child. He wants equal rights for all of them. In fact, he'll take special regard, he'll take special care for the handicapped child, because the others can stand on their own 2 feet. So when you look at how the animals regard us, those of you who have pets, or those of you who live in a semi-farm area like this, they have a natural reverence. They have a natural awe. Just like if you ever had a little brother. A little brother just worships his big brother. It's a natural thing. But if the big brother one time just comes up and just breaks his nose and knocks him to the pavement, kicks him, just imagine how that natural trust is violated. Just imagine the shock. He'll never recover from that. Never recover from that. Worship and honor, and that person just comes up and mutilates you and manhandles you. So animals have that natural reverence for human beings, but just think of how much they feel betrayed when we violate them and send them to the slaughterhouses. I don't know what this is exactly. Looks like he's beating his child. Riots. Can we deny that brutality against animals makes us, against animals, makes us brutal too? I don't think so. The more animals we eat, it seems like the more violence there is in the world. And it's escalating all the time. These are some of the trains in India. This is the train that was going to Ayodhya. This was a train of pilgrims, of Hindus that were going to Ayodhya to visit the birthplace of Lord Ram. And the train was set on fire and the people were burned. Hundreds and hundreds of people were burned in the train. That was not so long ago. And then you see the rise of meat in India. You know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, very, very few people ate meat. 80 or 90 years ago, if someone didn't eat meat, they had to do it in the dark moon night. They were so ashamed that they would never do it in daylight. They would never do it in public. But they would wait until it was an Amavasya, a dark moon. They would kill the animal and they would eat it in secret. So much of an exception was the practice of meat. Now, probably 80% of the restaurants in India are non-veg, 80%. And with the corresponding rise in meat eating, you see a population that was once known for its humility, submission, non-violence, the country from which the principle of non-violence, ahimsa, came, not only through Hinduism and Buddhism. Now you can see from some of these shocking images how much more violent people have become. Pythagoras is known as a mathematician, but he was a lot more than that. It's interesting when you read the life story of Pythagoras. We just know the Pythagorean theorem. But he was a lot more than a mathematician. He was a vegetarian. He was, you have Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. He was the guru of Plato, and he'd been to India. He'd been to India, so he was actually the mentor of Plato, who was the mentor of Socrates, who was the mentor of Aristotle. And he was a vegetarian. He said, those that kill animals to eat their flesh tend to massacre their own. There's the World Towers here, 9/11. And as an extension of what we're talking about, the karmic consequences, all of our actions, including our choice of food, have karmic consequences. By inflicting injury, pain, and death, one must in the future experience the suffering's cause. There's a principle, a karmic principle, what goes around comes around. But the reactions to a cruel deed today may take years. It may even take a lifetime before you get the reaction. That means the reactions that we're experiencing now may have come from seeds that we planted 10 years ago, 20 years ago, or even in a previous lifetime. Whenever you plant a seed, you don't immediately get a plant or a tree and a fruit. It takes time. First, it germinates, fructifies, then you get... And then and some of the fruits are going to be sweet and some of them are sour. So we don't get immediate consequences from our reactions. You know, what was it? Who was it? Pinocchio? Every time he told a lie, his nose got bigger. So imagine if that happened to us. Every time you told a lie, your nose got bigger, you know? If we had immediate consequence, every time you eat a hamburger, you know, someone slaps you across the back of the head or something like that. Every bite, you take a bite, and take another bite, take another bite. You know, you'd probably, you know, get yourself on the straight and narrow pretty quickly. But it doesn't work like that. You know, there's a delay. There's a delay. So the consequences, the karmic reactions that we're experiencing now are from seeds, deeds, and not of them are bad. I mean, they're pleasant consequences that are a result of philanthropic, charitable, altruistic, self-sacrificial deeds that we've done in the past too. But just like a tree, some of them are fruit, some of them are sweet, and some of them are bitter. They all entangle us in this material world. Both good and bad karma are entangling. If you have good karma, you have to come back, take another birth to enjoy the results of good karma. If you have bad karma, you come back and take another birth to suffer the results of bad karma. So they're both entangling, in fact. But every deed that we do with ourself as the center, as the enjoyer, is going to have consequences. Prabhupada says, by killing animals, not only will we be bereft of the human form of life, but we will have to take an animal form and some or other be killed by the same type of animal we have killed. That is the law of nature. There's a story of a hunter named Magrari, and it lends itself to drama. I've seen it performed a number of times. I've even played the role of Magrari myself. But he was a hunter, Narada Muni encountered the hunter Magrari in the forest one time. And Narada Muni's and Magrari's custom, which he'd learned from his father and his grandfather, was not to kill the animals outright, but to half kill them, to leave them suffering, writhing in agony. And he learned to enjoy that, you might say, by disciplic succession. So Narada Muni said, why do you do this? Why don't you just kill them outright? Why do you inflict extra amounts, measures of suffering upon them? And he said, well, I never really thought about it. My father used to do it, my grandfather used to do it, and so I just do it. And Narada Muni said, don't you realize that the same suffering that you mete out to the animal, that the animal will be able to come back and cause you the same amount of suffering in the next life? And Magrari doubted that, but Narada Muni said, the word in Sanskrit and Hindi for meat is manse, M-A-N-S-E. And that's a composite of two words, man and se. Man means me and se means him. So the very word for meat means what I do to him in this life, he gets to come back and do to me in the next life. And as Narada Muni was explaining this karmic principle to Magrari, Magrari had a vision where he actually saw in the next life, in his next life, all those animals were coming back with iron claws and iron corns, and they were subjecting him to the same type of suffering that he had inflicted upon them. The story has a happy ending. Magrari became transformed. And he asked Narada Muni, what can I do? He says, I've killed so many animals, and so what can I do? There's no hope for me. Now, this is where the lapse comes in. This is why there's not such a thing as instant karma. This is why there's a delay. Because the Lord doesn't take any pleasure in inflicting punishment on us. He would rather we, by internal introspection or discussion with others or consulting with the scriptures, He would rather that we, of our own, come to a higher level of consciousness and sensitivity and leave off the base barbaric practice of slaughtering animals. And if that's the case, if we do that, if we come to that level of conscience, then the punishment is no longer necessary. The punishment is only remedial. It's not gratuitous. So if you somehow or other relinquish the practice on your own, then the punishment that was scheduled for you becomes reduced by a great factor. Instead of getting stabbed in the back, maybe just stick, you know, you get a pinprick on your finger or something like that. So that's actually why the Lord arranges such a things as to have a delayed reaction. So we'll just read this and that should conclude. I think about ready to start the yoga here. Sanskrit word mamsa means meat. It is said mamsa kadati iti mamsa. I am now eating the flesh of an animal who will someday in the future be eating my flesh. So if we take anything away from this little session today, it would be that it is in our own selfish best interests not to cause suffering. If we don't have to, if we can maintain ourselves quite healthily and happily without inflicting suffering and bloodshed, then go ahead and do that. And that will not only be in the best interests of the animals, but that will be in your best interest. Because if all of our suffering is simply a karmic reaction to the suffering that we've caused, then it's entirely logical that let us reduce or even eliminate altogether the suffering that we cause, and that will have a beneficial rebound upon us. as we're reducing the suffering that we cause to others, we are in direct proportion reducing the sufferings and miseries in the future of our own lives. So we'll stop there. I think there's even enough material for another segment. We're on slide 118 out of 158 altogether, so we may...